welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for the week of April 22nd, 2019. My guest on the podcast this week is author and journalist Steve Oney. Steve is a graduate of the University of Georgia and was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. He worked for many years as a staff writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution magazine and has also contributed articles to many national publications, including Esquire, Playboy, Premier, GQ, the New York Times Magazine, and many others. Steve is the author of the definitive history of the notorious Leo Frank case, entitled And the Dead Shall Rise, The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Lynching of Leo Frank, a path-breaking book published by Pantheon in 2003 and winner of numerous awards, including the American Bar Association's Silver Gavel Award, the Southern Book Critics Circle Prize, the National Jewish Book Award, and the Georgia Historical Society's Bell Award for the Best Book in Georgia History. Steve lives in Los Angeles and is currently working on a history of NPR, National Public Radio, for Simon & Schuster. His latest book that I'm talking to him about is a collection of his magazine articles entitled A Man's World, A Gallery of Fighters, Creators, Actors, and Desperados, just out in paperback from the University of Georgia Press. This interview was recorded at the Jepson House Education Center in Savannah on April 12, 2019. Here's Steve Oney. Steve Oney, welcome to Off the Deaton Path.
Thanks, Stan. It's great to be here in Savannah and with you.
You're an old friend of the Georgia Historical Society. You and I first met in 2004 when your book, And the Dead Shall Rise, about the lynching of Leo Frank and the murder of Mary Fagan, won the Bell Award for the best book in Georgia history in 2003, published in 2003. I know that book won many awards, and I want to ask you a little bit about that, but you and I have been together and worked together in various ways over the last 15 years. So welcome back to Savannah, and thanks for taking the time to come out here.
Thanks again, Stan.
Your newest book is out from the University of Georgia Press in paper. I believe it was originally published about a year ago by Mercer.
Yes.
University Press. It's entitled A Man's World, A Gallery of Fighters, Creators, Actors, and Desperados. What is this book about?
This book is a collection of 20 profiles of men, some of them exemplary men, some of them incredible screw-ups, and it's a reflection of my 40-plus years as a magazine writer. The earliest piece in the book was published in 1977, the most recent just a couple years ago. So I have been at this business of writing magazine stories for 4 decades, and I've amassed a body of work, and I thought some of the best pieces just happened to be profiles of men. So I collected 20 of the best and wrote an introduction and imposed some order on the chaos and divided it into sections. There's a section about fighters, a section about creators, a section about actors, and a section about desperados. So it's 20 portraits of men.
And to back up a little bit, you had a long career in journalism. I believe you were born in Ohio.
Yes.
And then moved to Georgia when and how?
We moved to Tennessee when I was 6 years old, and I went to elementary school in Kingsport, Tennessee. Then we moved to Georgia, and I went to high school in Georgia. My dad was in the paper business, and his job in Atlanta, he was the sales rep for International Paper, for fine printing paper, and he had clients like Progressive Farmer and Southern Living. And I went to high school at Peachtree High School in Atlanta, which sadly no longer exists. And
class of what?
Class of 1972.
Okay.
And then came over to the University of Georgia and the class of 76.
Did you, I know that, were you worried in 1972? Was the draft still happening for Vietnam at that time?
Yes, I registered for the draft at the DeKalb County Courthouse July 28th, 1972, when I turned 18. Mm. And however, they had just instituted the lottery system, and I had a very high number, which essentially guaranteed I would not be drafted no matter what. It was 250-something, and if you were over 150, you weren't going to be called. So it was a looming presence, and in my high school, the older brothers of many of my classmates were there fighting, and a couple were killed, but it was not a threat to me.
So it wasn't a constant worry.
It was not a worry. I mean, I worried about the war, and I was, like most young people, opposed to the war, but I didn't have to stay up night fearing I was going to be called. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's impossible to put ourselves back in that moment where some people felt compelled to fight and others compelled to resist. And I think there was honor in both positions.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the war was winding down at that time. So you go to the University of Georgia. I know you're on the staff of the Red and Black there. Can you remember some of the most important professors that you studied with?
I had a great teacher, Dr. Kilgo, in the English department, who taught me both American Romanticism and American novels, and he was a fine author himself and a naturalist from Orangeburg, South Carolina. He wrote a book about nature called Deep Enough for Ivory Bills. Mm. Being out in the wilderness looking for the elusive ivory bill woodpecker. Mm-hmm. And he was a great teacher. And I always thought that you could distinguish a Southern education by what I learned in his class. He built his last lecture in the American Romanticism class to end on a quote from Thoreau. And he ended the last lecture of the last class with the words, Indian buffalo. And he was trying to leave us with these two powerful images of the wilderness. Now, a friend of mine was at the same time going to Northwestern, and he took a philosophy class, psychiatry, from Christopher Lash. And Lash ended his survey course with the word socialism. And I thought that was the difference between going to a Southern college and going to a liberal Northern college. Indian buffalo in the South, socialism up North. And I was the news editor of the Red and Black, but more importantly to me, and for the factual record, I was the editor of the student magazine, the Georgia Impression. And it was a quarterly magazine that had started in 1966 and had full equal rank with the Red and Black and the Pandora. It was the student magazine, funded in part by the university and in part by the ads that we sold. And I edited the magazine in 1974 and 75 and did some very aggressive issues. And that's really where I fell in love with magazine writing. And it was different than the Red and Black. We were, in a way, in competition with the Red and Black, except we, not in competition for news stories, but in competition for the attention of the students.
Mm-hmm. A couple of questions that I like to, talking to writers like you. How did you fall in love with writing, with words? Was there an influence in your young life? Had you always been a reader? And what kind of books did you read as a child?
I was always a reader. My mom taught me to read before I started school. I would just sit in her lap and she would read to me and then have me read back what she had read. And so by the time I was in first grade, I was a pretty good reader. And I read the Hardy Boys, Chip Hilton sports books. I read Swiss Family Robinson. I read adventure books and historical novels. And I loved a writer named Kenneth Roberts, who won the Pulitzer Prize back in the 1930s for a book called Northwest Passage. And he would write these big, bold accounts of American history, except fictionalized. And the first serious book I really read and fell in love with in high school was Oscar Wilde's The Portrait of Dorian Gray. Mm. And I don't know how that happened, but it was an assigned book my junior year of high school. And I think that's the first time I realized that writing could get at something very deep. And it's a gimmicky book about someone whose portrait gets younger as he ages. And so it's a kind of like a O. Henry story. It's got a lot of trickery, but he pulled it off and I realized, wow, this is, writing can get at a lot of magical things.
So you're working on the magazine, which I UGA, which I assume you had more room, more space, more words than say, in a newspaper.
It was a real magazine, and I would assign real stories. We did a issue on the New South, and the cover was quite controversial. It was an interracial couple, a caricature. It was a cartoon by Mike Lester, who's now a conservative editorial cartoonist. Conservative, but his cartoons are syndicated by the Washington Post, and he has a strip in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution called Mike DeJure. But Mike did a cover of an interracial couple. The man looked like Shaft, and the woman looked like Blanche DuBois, holding hands against the backdrop of the Confederate battle flag. And the cover line was the New South. And the implicit question in the issue was, is there a New South? And we did a story, a terrific story, about Capricorn Records in Macon, and a young writer went down, called up very, as one does, Hi, I'm Ed, I'm a University of Georgia student, can I come talk to you? And they invited him down and gave him the run of the place for a couple of days. I did a profile for that issue of J.B. Stoner, which was intense. He leveled some of the most racist remarks about the University of Georgia I'd ever heard, and I quoted them all, and only in retrospect, only as I got older, I spent the day with Stoner and Dr. Edward Fields at the headquarters of the Thunderbolt, the White People Party newspaper in Marietta. And only when I got older and I realized that J.B. Stoner had been associated with some true violence and ugliness in Georgia did I realize I spent a day with this madman and just, you know, blithely assuming that all was well. But In the aftermath, I figured there were guns everywhere in the office, and I didn't think I was personally at risk, but it was nonetheless a moment in my young experience. We had a story about good old boys and good old girls in that issue. We had a story about the experience of black students at the university. This was 1974, and the article was headlined Black Like Us, and it traced the progress that black students had made from the day that Charlene Hunter and Hamilton Holmes enrolled to 1974. And there was a sense among black students at the time that they wanted their own student union. There was a sort of feeling that they were there, but they were not really equal. And so the issue explored all these things, and I was trying to There was an incredibly prescient piece, actually, in the issue by a guy named Tom Stedman about the new conservatism, in which he predicted that Georgia was going to turn around and the Republican Party was going to get control of the state. And I thought that was a very smart article for a college kid to write in 1974. So we were trying to tackle important issues, important personalities, but do the work with style and humor and all the palette of materials that a magazine can draw from, the illustrations, the cartoons, great photography. It was very ambitious, and the University of Georgia sadly does not have a magazine now. And in fact, I was over in Athens last week for a week at the university and was talking with them about possibly establishing a new student magazine, because I think there's so much to learn. And our office, we had a manual typewriter, a beat up desk, a broken chair, and no telephone. And we got a little money from the university and were expected to make an issue out of nothing. Go in that office, think up some stories, assign them. And I think that was an invaluable learning experience to get these magazines done, printed, and in circulation with essentially no instruction and no equipment. So
would you say that's where you learned how to write? Was that the apprenticeship for you?
It was sort of an apprenticeship. I was allowed to make mistakes, and I think making mistakes is really important when you're young. And I was allowed to be ambitious and foolish and sometimes a little reckless, but also aspire to something that was good. And I wouldn't say I'd learned how to write. My favorite line about writing is Hemingway's line after he won the Nobel Prize, when he said, "It's a craft at which you'll always be an apprentice." So I feel like I'm learning how to write every day, a little bit at a time. And sometimes I feel I'm actually backsliding, and that some of what I did in my 20s was as good as or possibly better than what I'm doing now, because then I was unbridled and did not worry about some of the fine points, and that was liberating. Now I'm very conscientious, and I think very hard about what I'm doing.
And you went on to, and you and I could talk, I should say, for hours.
We could.
About all of the things that you've done and the subjects that you've covered. The Leo Frank case and the book you wrote about it deserves its own podcast that would probably be in five parts with an audience that would welcome that. I don't want us to run too far down that road. But continuing on, you left the University of Georgia, and did you begin work immediately at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution magazine, or was there an interlude?
There was a two-year interlude. I worked for 3 months at Advertising Age magazine in New York. I had an internship, you know, and some of my fellow interns went on to incredible careers. One of the other participants in the program, there were about 15 of us from colleges all over the country, was Michiko Kakatani. She was there from Yale. She became the chief book reviewer for the New York Times. So I did that the summer of 1975, and then I came back to the South, and I worked for the Greenville, South Carolina paper, The News, for 6 months as the business writer, a job for which I was absolutely ill-suited and unqualified, and I faked my way through 6 months of that. And then, because I really wanted to learn how to be a news writer, I got a job at the Anderson, South Carolina paper, The Independent, running its North Georgia bureau, covering 17 rural counties from Rabun County up at the north to Washington Wilkes down at the south, and pushing out into Banks County to the west. And I covered a couple of news stories every day, whether it was a car wreck or a murder or a city council meeting, and banging these stories out. And then I covered high school football or basketball Friday and Saturday night. So I was very busy, and I didn't have a lot of time to work on the pieces. I was doing spot news stories, and it was invaluable education. And it just so happened the Richard Russell Dam was being built, and there were a number of hearings and protests about it. And I covered those hearings, and I found an old house in Elbert County that was going to be destroyed, most likely, for the construction of the dam. And it's a plantation plain mansion out in the country with the dates of the structure's building carved on the inside of a stone in the fireplace. It's, I think, in the 1760s. It's an old house. And the editor of the Atlanta Journal and Constitution magazine had been in that house years before, and he read my newspaper story in the Anderson Independent about it, and he had a job opening, and he liked my newspaper story, and he offered me a job. And so at age 22, with 2 years of experience, I came to work for the Atlanta Journal and Constitution magazine, and I had no idea how lucky I was. But Jimmy Carter had been sworn in as president 3 or 4 weeks before I started work, and suddenly Atlanta was the hottest place in America, and the management of the then Daily Journal and Constitution put a lot of money and aspiration into beefing up both the papers and the Sunday magazine, and I was the beneficiary of that. For the next 5 years, the magazine aspired to be as good as any magazine in America. Whether we got there, that's a matter for debate, but we at least tried, and we had the full support of the management of the Atlanta papers to make the effort. And it was very, very heady and very hard work. And the staff writers and staff photographers had not much downtime, but it was a remarkable moment in Georgia's history. And it just so happened I was there to pick up on it and be part of it. So I'm very grateful for that.
And for those listeners who may not know this, at that time, the Atlanta Constitution came out in the morning. The Atlanta Journal was an afternoon newspaper. They had different, I think, editorial teams writing for each one.
Yeah, they were completely distinct newspapers with distinct news staffs, distinct sports staffs. Mm-hmm. And if you read the Constitution in the morning, the Journal would often contradict it in the afternoon. They were in competition, and they would try to break stories on each other, even though they shared ownership. And they had separate editorial columnists and separate editorial positions on issues in the state. And they would get into it. And the Sunday magazine was the one place in the operation, which was then in downtown Atlanta at 72 Marietta Street. The magazine was where there was a truce, and it came out with both papers on Sunday. So the magazine was supposed to be the considered reflection of the institution in a weekly format, and we pulled in a lot of great writers from all over the South. Pat Conroy wrote for us. Tony Cade Bambera, the poet and novelist, wrote for us. Marshall Frady, Paul Hemphill. These were big names in Georgia and the South at the time. And we excerpted books. We really tried to cover national stories, except with a regional hook of some sort. Mm-hmm. And it was a... it was a big deal, but magazines for newspapers were the canaries in the coal mine of the publishing business, and they started dying off in the late 80s, and it was a real signal that the advertising world and the structure was changing, and then online came along and really put the fear of the Lord in the business plan, destroyed the business plan of most American newspapers. But I was lucky to get in when it was still very, very healthy.
And growing up in Gwinnett County, my parents took the Atlanta Journal, which was delivered every afternoon. Mm-hmm. My father read the newspaper every evening. It was my grandmother who lived with us. And I watched them read newspapers, and I would read the sports page and the comics. And that's how I learned to read a newspaper. I'm remembering that there was one paper on Sunday. Did they
eat? Right, they combined on Sunday. Okay. They combined the and it was put out under the auspices of the Journal. Mm-hmm. And so it had a very strong Atlanta Journal component. Mm-hmm. And the strongest part of it was the sports section. The Sunday sports section on a football weekend was a glorious thing. Mm-hmm. And the Atlanta papers had a staff writer at every SEC game and most of the ACC games and expended a tremendous amount of resources to give you a full report illustrated with state-of-the-art photography and graphics of that time. So when you picked up the Sunday newspaper on a fall weekend, it was a bounty that, you know, gave, if you were, especially if you were an SEC football fan, which I was, it was a thing of beauty. And it, no one could afford to do that job this way today, but that was one of their strong selling points.
Mm-hmm. And they had columnists like Louis Grizzard writing. They had Furman Bischer.
Yeah, Furman Bischer was and Louis, they both were incredible writers.
Yeah, and the magazine, there aren't any, outside of the New York Times, I don't know that any newspaper still publishes a magazine on Sunday, but these things were a wonder to behold. I mean, they were real magazines. They weren't just inserts. It was a real magazine with a lot of illustrations and ads and wonderful writing, and you could spend all of Sunday afternoon with the magazine and the paper.
When it was good, it was that way. When it was bad, it would put you to sleep. There'd be just a lot of verbiage, and you'd wonder why trees were being sacrificed for this, but they were good when they were good, and when they were bad, they were horrid. But when they were good, I'm thinking back, grits became a big thing when Carter was president, and there were gourmet grits recipes being proffered by Craig Claiborne and others, and I did a whole story about grits in Georgia and went down to the last grits grinding grist mill in Georgia, which was at the Georgia Agorama. It had been moved there, and hung out with these guys who knew the fine point of setting the millstones to grind grits as opposed to meal, and ran me off what felt like a gallon of fresh grits. They were amazing, and I learned grits poetry. And so I could take off on these tangents. My grits poem is by Roy Blunt, and a couple of lines are, "Grits, grits, grits I sing, grits fits in with anything. Two bits, four bits, fish grits and collards. Life is good where grits are swallowed." And, I had the chance to just run with a subject like that. There was no real news value to a story on grits, but they put it on the cover with a beautiful photograph that made grits look like it was the most expensive and beautiful haute cuisine. And then this entire story I got to write about grits. So you could have a notion, and it could be whimsical like that or very serious, and the newspaper would say, all right, go for it. Go spend 6 weeks. Don't call us until you're done and then come back with it. And that was an incredible gift. Mm-hmm. I think to the readers and certainly to me as a young writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know the genesis of some of the essays that you have put together in this book, A Man's World, began, I think, there's an essay here on Harry Cruz that I think probably began while you were writing for the AJC magazine. Am I right about that?
I wrote a profile of Harry Cruz in 1977 for the Journal of Constitution magazine. It was the first big piece I did for the magazine. I had just joined it, and I was an enormous fan of Harry's writing, and he had finished, but not yet published, his nonfiction book, A Biography of a Place, about growing up poor during the Depression in Bacon County, Georgia. And people think it's his masterpiece, but that was the hook for me writing the piece. Harry was teaching English at the University of Florida at the time, so I flew down to Gainesville and spent a couple days with Harry, who was a wild man and was misbehaving the entire time I was with him, but all that made it an even better story, and wrote a story about this Georgia novelist who was working on what would turn out to be his masterpiece about growing up poor in South Georgia. And that was my first big story for the Atlanta papers.
Before I begin throwing names at you of these people that you interviewed who you've got essays about in this book, I just want to ask you a little bit about your method, about how you approach a subject. When you're given an assignment or when you, and I'll pick a name here, Greg Allman, what's the first thing that Steve Oney does in preparation for talking to people? How do you approach your subject? Do you intensely read about them, or do you go in with a blank mind? Do you ask a lot of questions? Do you observe? And I know all of this depends on how much time you have with them, but how do you approach people that you write about?
I try to read everything I can find about them. And I will, in the old days, I would make Xerox copies. Now I'll keep a file of links to these stories on my computer. And I think of questions, things I want to know, things that in earlier articles a writer might have missed or could have developed more fully. So I rarely go in blind. I want to have a body of knowledge about the person I'm writing about. And then when I do start to work, once I've been given an assignment by a publication and have some assuredness that the article, if I pull it off, will actually see print, I contact the person and ask to spend time with them. And ideally, I don't interview them very much. I just spend time with them, watching. And with Greg Allman, I was with him and his band for a week while they were on tour. And yes, I talked to Greg from time to time, but I also just watched the band put together each evening's equipment and watched them as they interacted, the members of the band. And, you know, in a pure sense, those observations allow you to write about people as if you're an artist sketching them. You're not imposing yourself as the journalist. You're seeing them at work and hoping that if you take careful notes on their conversation and on their banter, you're going to have a sense of them living in the moment. Now, that doesn't always work, at which point I will interview people. I'll sit down and talk with them as much as they will talk and ask them extensively about things. And sometimes the conversations begin with some meandering stuff that's never going to get into my story, but I'm trying to develop a level of comfort and trust with the person I'm speaking to, and we will eventually get to what does matter. Now, I don't always have that much time. Sometimes I've got to work fast and, you know, I've got to get right to the point. But in an ideal world, I have a good deal of time and can move at a leisurely pace.
And there's certain people here I want to ask you about specifically. At what period in their life you were with them, mm-hmm. And then just what they were like, what insights you gleaned from them, and talk about Greg Allman first. What period of his career was this? And talk a little bit about what it was like spending that week with him, what you saw.
I wrote a profile of Greg Allman for Esquire in 1984, and Greg's life was falling apart. The glory days of the Allman Brothers were 10 years in the past. Greg had just conquered an addiction to heroin. He was an alcoholic and claimed he had joined AA and was sober, but he was drinking nonetheless. He had just gotten divorced from Cher after a very rocky marriage that she tried to annul 2 or 3 days after the marriage, and they got back together, but things were never right. And he was a forgotten man in the world of rock and roll and blues. So I pitched the story to Esquire, and I then pitched it to Greg and to his handlers. And Greg was looking for some national publicity as he hoped to resurrect his career. So I met Greg in Boston and followed him for 5 or 6 days on a tour. We ended up in Columbus, Ohio, after being in Baltimore and other spots. And, you know, I just hung out with the band. I had no illusion that I was going to be their friend, but the first night I was working on the story in Boston, one of the band members, Danny Toler, who was the new lead guitarist, I would have said he replaced Dwayne, but no one could replace Dwayne, but Danny was an incredible guitarist, and Danny got very sick, and the show ended with Danny essentially falling off the back of the stage, and Greg, who loved Danny, had to get the tour bus to take Danny to the emergency room of a hospital in Boston, and I was just there. I was with them when Danny got sick. I got on the bus. It was just the three of us and the driver rushing to an emergency room someplace at 11 o'clock at night and standing with Greg in the emergency room as he waited to see what the verdict was going to be. And when he got a sense that Danny was all right, going back to the hotel with Greg and watching him pick up a woman who looked like Cher. And, you know, I was just part of the entourage, except I was taking notes. A writer I love, Nora Ephron, said that a good magazine writer is like a wallflower at the orgy. You are there, but you are not participating. You are taking notes. You're watching how things develop. And your job is not to be involved. Your job is as a professional witness, in a sense. So Greg was really on the ropes when I wrote this piece. And anything bad that could happen did happen to him. My experience with Greg ended in Los Angeles, where he was a guest on Alan Thicke's short-lived talk show, Thick of the Night, which is one of the only shows ever to get a zero in the Nielsen ratings. And, you know, that's where Greg was trying to resurrect his career, because that was the only booking he could get. And it was evidence of how far he'd fallen, but evidence that he had not given up. And even if he was going to be forced to scramble to resurrect his career in the very lowest rungs of entertainment, he was going to fight to get back. And he did. The great thing about magazine pieces is they're a snapshot or a short movie of a point in time or several points in time. And the story about Greg ended with him not yet out of the woods. He was very much in the woods, in fact. But it's a real portrait of someone who won't give up, who's driven by some life force and believes he has something to say artistically. And, you know, lo and behold, for the next 35 years, Greg had a very successful career and was, you know, a featured artist at the Beacon Theater in New York every year and went on to have a full life. But I saw him at this sad, sad moment, and I bore witness to it, and I didn't sugarcoat it, as we say at our house. I didn't try to make it nice. It's a dark picture of a dark time.
I love how you ended that piece.
Well, thank you. The ending works. I was with Greg and Danny in Los Angeles in their hotel room, and it was a pretty grungy hotel, and here was Greg, who just a few years before had been living with Cher in her mansion about 10 miles to the west. But it's 11 o'clock at night, he's fighting alcoholism, he orders some room service, and at this point I was part of Greg's life, so I'm just standing there with them as he unbuttons his pants and sits down to his room service meal, accompanied by a big pitcher of iced tea, because heaven forbid that anything alcoholic would be in the room. And after he finishes eating, he and Danny take the plate warmers on the room service cart and throw them around the room like frisbees, and Greg collapses into his bed and just says, "I'm beat." And that's the end of the piece. And it's, he was beat, but he hadn't quit, but he was beat.
Mm. Harrison Ford. At what point was this, and talk about him?
I profiled Harrison Ford for Premiere Magazine, the monthly entertainment and movie magazine that I think was fantastic. And it was a joint publication of Rupert Murdoch and Hachette Media. And I was the first staff writer for this magazine in Los Angeles and wrote some of their big pieces the first couple years of publication. But Harrison Ford, unlike Greg Allman, was at the very height of his fame. He had been in 2 Indiana Jones movies at that point, this was 1988.
Okay.
2 Star Wars films, and he was had just finished filming a movie called Frantic, directed by Roman Polanski, about the abduction of a wife of an American cardiologist in Paris during the first blush of terrorism in Paris that we would see blossom into such a grotesque and deadly part of our modern life. And so Harrison had a movie coming out. He had a reason to cooperate with Premiere Magazine doing a cover story about him. We assigned a very high-powered photographer to take the cover picture of Harrison standing in the Snake River in Wyoming fly fishing. And I went to Wyoming to interview Harrison and to spend as much time as possible with him. But Harrison, because he was such a big star, was absolutely guarded about the kind of access he would give me, even though our magazine was going to put him on the cover. So as I got there, I was told, you cannot visit my house. You cannot name the city I live in. You cannot name the state I live in. And if you're willing, as I put it in the piece, to look down the barrel of my preconceptions, you know, I'll tolerate your presence for a couple of days here in what I can now say was Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And, you know, when I do an assignment like this, I'm not trying to make friends with someone. I'm trying to see them as they are. So I'm not personally offended by Harrison's standoffishness or his prickliness. I think, oh, this is who this guy is. And one of the reasons he's this way is he's probably the biggest star in the world at that time. And he doesn't want people eavesdropping on his life. He doesn't want the kind of attention. He said to me later as I was interviewing him, he said, you know, my work is who I am. You can see exactly who I am if you watch my movies, because that's me up there. I'm not faking it. That's me. And why did people want to know more? Well, of course, we're fascinated by movie stars and we want to know more. But I used Harrison's laconic personality to, I think, paint a picture of who he is. So I show him being prickly and standoffish and tough and querulous, but I don't think in a mean way. I think it just, this is who the guy is. And I do a lot of interviews around the people I write about. So I try to talk to all their best friends and as many of their enemies as who will talk to me, their co-workers. I do an awful lot of, I don't just depend on the experience of being with someone. And, you know, one of the people I interviewed said, you know, Harrison's always going to be the upperclassman in any encounter. You're always going to be the freshman. And that's just who he is. He's a controlling guy. So I think the story, it's not a super long story. The stories in the book range from 3,000 words to 15,000 words, and that's probably a 5,000-word story. But I think that's Harrison Ford. I would stand by it 30 years later and say that's still who Harrison Ford is. That's one of the nice things about a magazine piece. If you get just enough access and do enough of your homework, you can capture someone in the same way that a portrait painting can get a quick sketch that will preserve them as they are. And that's always my goal in these pieces, to capture someone in amber or to catch you know, I've got all sorts of metaphors for it, to catch a firefly in a jar, to, you know, get the essence of life for a moment as I saw it and as I believe, supported by strong research, the subject of the piece is experiencing it, and then write it and stay out of the way.
Nick Nolte.
Well, Nick Nolte, also a cover story for Premiere magazine a year later, 1989, was the exact opposite of Harrison. Nick was out there, extrovert, long-suffering artist, and in a way a character out of a Jack Kerouac novel. He wore his passion and his confusion on his sleeve. There was what you... Nick didn't hide things. Harrison hid. Harrison believed he could control his environment. Nick just thinks it's chaos, and I'm part of the chaos. And at the time I was working on the piece, Nick was in some psychological state, not Wyoming, and was wearing surgical scrubs every day. He wore mismatched surgical scrubs held up by a elastic back brace, whether he was going to a nice restaurant for dinner or playing golf or whatever he was doing. He never changed his outfit because he said, I'm crazy and I'm just dressed like a crazy man. And now Nick was a huge star at this point. It was before he did Prince of Tides, but he'd done already 48 Hours and Down and Out in Beverly Hills and Rich Man, Poor Man, the miniseries that really made him a star. And I met Nick. He agreed to the profile in Premiere and said I could spend as much time as possible with him. And the first time I spent with him was at a very good golf club in Los Angeles where he played 18 holes wearing this outrageous outfit. And he played with some of his buddies. And, you know, all the other golfers who were well-dressed and, you know, would have been at home at Augusta National, they would ride by and their jaws would drop. And who's that crazy man playing golf? Well, that's Nick Nolte. And Nick actually was a very good athlete. Nick had played college football 1 year in Arizona. So he's out there. And
he played a football player in North Dallas 40.
Yeah, North Dallas 40. Really one of my favorite
movies.
And
With
Mac Davis.
Mac Davis, yeah.
And it's a great novel by Pete Gent, who had played for the Dallas Cowboys. And I read the novel first, and one of the reviews of the novel said, Peter Gent is not a football player who wrote a novel. Peter Gent is a novelist who played pro football. And Peter Gent was just... there was a ruthless and sarcastic quality to his writing about the pieties and the paradoxes of football. And so he played for the Dallas Cowboys for Tom Landry, a very good man, a very Christian, forthright man who stood for the best values, is running this dynastic football team where all the players are drunk and womanizing, and Peter Gent really captured that paradox of life in the NFL, and then Nick played the Peter Gent character in the movie as a fading tight end on the Dallas Cowboys who has to get injections of cortisone and other drugs just to play in a game. And it was about the battle to stay in a sport where the rewards are very great and the risks psychologically and physically are also very great. And I think it's the most realistic book or film I've ever encountered about the NFL. I mean, Semi-Tough is also very good, the Dan Jenkins book and the film of the same name. But North Dallas 40, I'm a disciple for North Dallas 40. That's really what sold me on Nick Nolte.
Yeah, that's the first thing I ever saw him in and became a huge fan. But he was just a free spirit.
A free spirit and still is. And, you know, sadly, that piece ends at a bar. And Nick is with Lee Majors, who was another athlete turned actor. And Lee had just filmed a commercial. Actors used to do this someplace in Southeast Asia, for which he'd earned $500,000 and a huge payday. And actors would go make money doing commercials abroad to fill up their bank account, but it didn't really hurt their reputation in Hollywood because no one saw them.
Right.
And so Nick had all this, Majors had all this money. They were at a bar, and Majors kept ordering double screwdrivers for Nick, and Nick was soon paralyzed with drink. And it was funny at the time, but 4 or 5 years later, Nick got arrested for DUI in Malibu, and it was not funny at all. And some of us have in our memory bank the arrest photograph of Nick in Malibu, and he was a sick man at that point. It had gone too far. You can't live out of control the way Nick was living and get out of this life, or at least lead a sane life. So Nick had to confront his demons. But you see all that coming in my piece. Mm-hmm. But it was before it had caught up with him.
Herb Alpert, one of the great musicians, I suspect he was a very different person.
Well, that's a name from the past, and younger listeners aren't going to know Herb Alpert. But in the 1960s, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, one year they sold more records than the Beatles, maybe 1966. Mm-hmm. And they were instrumentals, by and large. Taste of Honey, The Lonely Bull. And Herb was a supremely talented trumpet player, and he was the front man of this band. And
still is.
And he's playing in his mid-80s now and has not really lost a step. But he also did something else. He founded A&M Records. He was the A in A&M, Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. And it was one of the most innovative independent record labels and had a huge impact on American music, both from the early 60s when they started it on through the 80s. So The Police, Sting, The Go-Go's,
The Carpenters
in the 70s, many huge acts. And so Herb and Jerry sold A&M Records in the 90s, and I'm pretty sure that Herb is a billionaire. They only got $500 million for the label, but combined with all his earnings, the point of my story is that I come along and write this piece in 2011 for Los Angeles Magazine, and Herb has started a foundation in Los Angeles and is giving away tens of millions of dollars to elementary school systems that have ceased their arts department, which has, you know, been one of the tragic cuts in our economy. Everyone thinks, what does a liberal arts degree lead to? It can't get you a job. What will art or music classes create for you? Well, they're an indulgence. I would argue, and Herb would argue stronger than I would, that au contraire, arts education and liberal arts education is the beginning of the creativity that actually will allow you to, if you go in a different direction, build a business or make an opportunity for financial gain, that it's the encouragement of the imagination that leads to success. So Herb endowed the School of Music at UCLA. He endowed the School of Music at CalArts, which is in Los Angeles. And he, at the time I wrote this story, had given away about $300 million. And in the intervening few years, he's given away many millions of more dollars. He read an article in the New York Times that the Harlem School of the Arts had fallen on hard times. And he immediately wrote a $500,000 check and issued it as a challenge grant, and someone else made up the $500,000, and they were on their way to stabilizing this cornerstone of arts education in Harlem. So he's an amazing person, and a person who, you know, has a contradictory trait. He's very creative himself. He's a serious musician who plays every day and also sculpts and paints. But he's a person who's not threatened by other creative people. He wants to give encouragement to other creative people. And if he can't give them personal encouragement, he wants to give money to institutions that can provide that encouragement. And he's a shy person, a thoughtful person. Like a lot of musicians, he speaks through his instrument. And it's when he's playing a trumpet that he's most comfortable. But he's had this long and very generous life where he started out creatively, and now he's continuing as a trumpet player and nurturing others. It was a pleasure to spend time with Herb.
A nice guy.
Very nice guy, very sweet guy. You can tell so many things about people just in the little things they do. If you go to Herb's house, you know, he's going to want to make sure you have a cup of coffee or to put you at ease. And he's going to tell you, be careful of the traffic out there when you make a turn. He's a thoughtful person and a nice guy. And in a world where nice guys usually finish last, he's a nice guy who's finished first.
And speaking of last, the last person I'm going to ask you about, and we've only been able to talk about four people out of 20 that are in this book, and I'm just going to encourage people to go get this.
Well, thanks.
But the last person I'm going to, because we're in Georgia and because we're talking about, you're sitting in the Georgia Historical Society, Herschel Walker.
I wrote a profile of Herschel Walker, for Playboy magazine, and...
And in Georgia, he doesn't even need a last name, does he?
Yeah, he's just Herschel, or number 34, and... The hook for the article was that at age 50, Herschel had gotten involved in mixed martial arts. He'd become a cage fighter and had become very good at it and had won his first two fights. And it was an insane thing to do because he was fighting guys in their 20s. And for those of you who don't know about mixed martial arts, it's a combination of karate, boxing, judo, Muay Thai boxing, several oriental arts, and you can hurt people in multiple ways. And the boxers don't wear heavy gloves as traditional boxers wear. They wear little light gloves, and a punch can knock you out. They kickbox, a kick to the head can knock you out. They can pin you and bar your arm to the point of breaking, and you tap out to end the match. So I spent a couple days with Herschel at the American Kickboxing Academy in San Jose, California, and the athletes there were some of the best athletes I've ever seen in my life. The conditioning, the skill, and they were not brawlers. Most of them had been Division I NCAA wrestlers, many of them wrestling champions or Olympic wrestlers. And so Herschel Walker gets involved in this when he's twice the age of everyone else, prospers at it or excels at it. And Herschel's whole life has been built on similar accomplishments of taking on a task or an athletic pursuit that he might not have been suited for and doing it as a dare almost. And Herschel is a great athlete. There's no doubt. He is a gifted athlete. But what I think is most remarkable about Herschel is that he's very smart and he's very creative. So if someone tells Herschel no, he's going to figure out a creative solution to get to yes. And when he was a kid, he was overweight. He had a stutter. He got himself in shape at his high school in Wrightsville. He built a contraption, took a huge truck tire, filled the tire with shots that you would use in shot put, the heavy 16-pound balls, and then attached the tire to a harness and spent much of his junior year running around the track of the high school in Wrightsville pulling that thing behind him. And he was, again, his sophomore year, he was a chubby, pokey kid who got beat up, got his lunch money stolen sometimes. By the end of his junior year, he was the fastest sprinter in the state of Georgia, and in his senior year, he was the most highly recruited football player in the country. So to me, Herschel is a self-invented person, and I think that's what's most interesting about him, and that's what I tried to bring to the fore in the article. That, and Herschel has got demons. Herschel has been depressed. Herschel has this controversial diagnosis of suffering from dissociative identity disorder, split personality. He hears voices in his head. He has a lot of stuff that he's handling, and he's a complicated person, and I admire him enormously. And, you know, I'd followed him all through his college and his pro career, and as a reporter at the Atlanta Papers, I was working there when Herschel came along, and I was lucky enough to see a game at Sanford Stadium against Vanderbilt where he gained, I think, 249 yards, and Vince Dooley took him out of the fourth quarter. He didn't even play after that. He would have gained 350 yards if they'd kept him in the game. So I was quite aware of him as a phenom, a college phenom, but as he got older, he would do these things that he competed in the, I think, 1988 Olympics in the two-man bobsled competition and finished seventh, you know, which is a pretty honorable finish. He danced with the Fort Worth Ballet just because he thought that'll be great for me as an athlete to learn balletic movement. And he was serious about it. Anything he does, he's serious about it. And I like him. He's an enormously nice guy on top of all that. So there's nothing, I got nothing bad to say about Herschel Walker. I suppose if I'd played defense against him in sports, I would have bad things to say, but because you've seen the photographs of him running over people at different stages in his athletic career.
He was one of the first football players who was incredibly fast and incredibly strong. I mean, the power he had in his legs to run over people, the famous first game against Tennessee in 1980 when he ran over Bill Bates. They became teammates later in Dallas.
Briefly held the 60-yard dash world record. He was at a meet someplace when he was in college, and he set the record, and then three or four heats later, Carl Lewis beat Herschel, and Carl Lewis held that record. But that was the speed that Herschel Walker had, that Herschel Walker could be mentioned in the same breath with Carl Lewis. He was that fast, but he was twice as big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I encourage everyone listening to read this book. It's fascinating. The title is A Man's World, A Gallery of Fighters, Creators, Actors, and Desperados. It's just out in paper from the University of Georgia Press. The author is Steve Oney, who is also, of course, the author of the prize-winning book about the lynching of Leo Frank entitled And the Dead Shall Rise. Steve, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Stan, thank you so much. What a pleasure, and what a great thing in my life that you and the Georgia Historical Society are a part of it, because I so believe in both you and the institution. So if you're listening and are coming to Savannah, you got to come visit this place.
Thanks, Steve.
That concludes our interview with author and writer Steve Oney. You can follow Steve on Twitter at Steve Oney Writer. The interview was conducted at the Jepson House Education Center in Savannah on April 12, 2019. The hardest working engineer in show business, also the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the key member of the soon-to-be-unveiled GHS Arena football team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our mailman this week and every week is Crimson Tide fan extraordinaire, one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised, that's right, who is away this week attending the Yadkin Valley Wine Festival in Elkin, North Carolina, but he promises to be back next week. Our legal counsel this week and every week is provided by the law offices of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, a good lawyer knows the law, a great lawyer knows the judge. Catering this week provided by Hagee's House of Tacos, home of Big Al's wood-fired, newly hired, reacquired, tightly wired, license expired, sick and tired, recently retired, runs like it's hot-wired, highly undesired, leftover from the Ottoman Empire, drippy enchilada. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. And you can now listen on Spotify as well. Tell your friends and family, because my mother will be very disappointed if you don't. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com. Please also check out my blog and similarly prize-winning podcast at deatonpath.georgiahistory.com. If you have any comments about the show or about life in general, please drop me a line at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. As always, thank you for listening. So long, everybody.